We are living in an unprecedented era of environmental change. From global warming to global population growth to the resultant demand for more food and more energy, it's time to put all eyes on Earth. The two people you're about to hear from believe this unfolding transformation and the resulting social and cultural upheaval must be seen to be understood. We're going to explore with them how Eyes on Earth seeks to nurture a new generation of visual storytelling to chronicle this new age of man. We're also going to talk about why making the underlying causes of environmental change visible and accessible for public discussion and policy decision making is so important, as well as talking about the importance of establishing clear and effective ways that environmental photography can make a difference for our world and its future. And indeed, I can say it did for me already. So welcome, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, I thank you for being a part of it, because we appreciate it and you. Eyes on Earth, the Anthropocene Epic. I hope you're ready to learn with me about the confluence of environment and photography, the nexus where human aspiration and the planet collide. I'm very excited, and I think all of you can tell, and actually thrilled to welcome our guests for this next hour, Jim Richardson, National Geographic photographer, Eyes on Earth, and Dennis Dimmock, National Geographic editor. That's the short version of who they are, but I apologize to them before we got on air, saying this is a long introduction, but both of you merit that. You deserve it, and I want our listeners to get a sense for who exactly we're all going to be spending time with. So in addition to being a photographer for National Geographic magazine, Jim is also a contributing editor for its sister publication, Traveler magazine. And if you haven't seen it, you should. He has photographed more than 30 stories for National Geographic. Jim's work takes him around the world, from the tops of volcanic peaks to below the surface of swamps and wetlands. ABC News Nightline produced a story about the long process of assembling a National Geographic coverage by following Richardson in the field and at National Geographic Society headquarters in Washington, D.C. Our other amazing guest, Dennis Dimmock, is an American journalist, photographer, presenter, educator, and citizen of the Anthropocene. And I have to add, they are both hysterical. That's not part of the official presentation, but they're really fun. Jim served for years as executive environment editor for National Geographic magazine and was picture editor for National Geographic Society for more than 35 years until retiring in December 2015. He continues in a consulting editorial role. And I certainly hope that just that introduction alone sets the stage for an incredible, thought-provoking, and informative show. Jim and Dennis, thank you so much for being here. And I hope you're ready and have a sense for how thrilled I am to have you both with me for this next hour. Welcome.
You're very gracious, too, and you don't exaggerate too much, I don't think.
I am a drama queen, but not one of those words was exaggerated. And I stole one of the quotes from one of you, and I just thought, oh, that's eloquent, and I hope people attribute it to me, because I do believe about the nexus and the confluence and all of that, but it's really just... I thought about human inspiration, not just aspiration. Okay, so let's get on with it. First, let me say that when I saw your presentation at Planet Forward this past spring, I was pretty much speechless, and I know that I wasn't the only one, but it is a rarity for me to be speechless, and that I was blown away, not just by the beauty of what I saw, but the impact of it on me and everyone else in the audience. So that's why I couldn't wait to have you here and get you started on sharing your story. So if I may, I'd like to start out with it might not be the most obvious question, but it's something I wanted to know. With what you both have accomplished with your lives and your work and given your incredible contribution to humanity, where did it start in each of you? Like, who or what started you on this amazing and impactful path?
Mm. Well, I think if you'll, Dennis will let me jump in here.
Please.
We both have similar backgrounds in a way. As you remember from the Planet Forward presentation, you know, we harked back to our youth because we both came from farms. Me in Kansas and Dennis in Oregon, and we both had that kind of background of being close to the land. And as much as anything, when we were speaking to those young people at Planet Forward, you know, I think that was the inspiration, is to say that we had our pivot point back, even if we didn't know it at the time, on the farms, near the land, noticing what was happening all around us, you know, and making that part of our daily life. And I think that was what was so inspiring with the students there, was that we realized that they're at a pivot point in their life, you know. And by sharing that where we came from, we might give them their pivot.
Yeah. So my situation was growing up on a small sheep and hay farm in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Both of my parents were fisheries biologists, and I spent a lot of time up in the woods in the Cascade Mountains of Oregon because my dad liked to go fishing and camping. And so my childhood really was populated by living on a farm, raising animals, raising crops, and also being connected to the wild places. But when I was in high school, our farm was cut in half by an interstate highway, and we lost about a third of it to, I guess you could say, progress. And so that combined with watching the old growth forest that I grew up with as a kid in the Cascade Mountains, seeing those being clear cut, both of those situations raised my awareness about environmental issues and the price of progress. And then after college, I have to admit that I found myself continuing to ask these kinds of questions. And I began to rely on, believe it or not, the Whole Earth Catalog, which was just celebrated its 50th anniversary this past weekend in San Francisco. And that was where I began to learn about how things were connected, learning about ecosystems and the biosphere and the reliance that humanity has on this planet in ways that I never really learned in college. And so that was a vital thing for me. And then also then beginning to work with Jim now. We've worked together. Gosh, the first story that we did was in 1991, I believe, was on the Colorado River and what was the future of this stream that was providing water for a very arid Southwest. And we went on to many other stories over the years.
And it's wonderful to see it on the website, to see how many covers of National Geographic you were involved with and in. And it just, I mean, it gives people a sense of it, which those were great answers. But what my observation is that so many guests I've interviewed, whether it's from Jane Goodall, who got her inspiration working in the garden, that's part of her story, and being just enthralled with, you know, animals and Tarzan. She's very funny when you interview her. And then Paul Hawkins. And people like Rorick Palman, who was at Planet Forward, there's always somehow in the description a connection to nature. It starts there, and that's so not happening with so many kids. And I sound like a preacher when I'm saying, connect your kid with nature. Connect your kids with nature. There's a park in every city. Just, you know, build a little garden on your balcony if it's an apartment. But thank you for sharing that. It just affirms my belief. And it's part of why I am Mrs. Green, because my parents took us out in nature, and it was magic. It was really magic. So in my research, I couldn't quite figure out, this is like the most enviable of every environmental photographer's position or dream, to work for National Geographic. How did what you were doing put you both in front of the most internationally recognized publication of its kind? What happened that got you on that magnificent path?
Gina, I was gonna hark back a little bit to in answer to your first question and to this, you know, to the background of I said I was on a farm, but you know, now I had the big advantage, I think, of being a bit of a loner, you know, and so I was in a place where I didn't have a lot of friends, but I did have a lot of stuff around, like microscopes and binoculars and cameras and I made model airplanes. I did all those kind of things. But one of the earliest lessons I had was that it was fun to see things, and it was fun to learn how to see things, and that this stuff was all around us, you know. Now, I didn't have the Dennis's benefit of having you know Mount Hood in the background of the farm, you know.
That's a nice background.
I was out in Kansas, and I like to tell people, you know, that we did not have wildlife where I grew up. We had varmints, you know. We had,
right.
and it was very much a thing that everybody else had wolves and we had coyotes, you know. It was a matter of figuring out that this is nature. And it is visible, and you can learn to see. I think that was one of the most fundamental things that was a tripping point for me, you know. And so when I was using my dad's camera and putting the lens up to the eyepiece of the microscope so that I could watch and perhaps get a picture of a paramecium, you know, splitting in two, you know, that's pretty exciting stuff for an 11-year-old kid, you know. All of a sudden, you know, that real stuff of nature is happening right there in front of you, you know. And it realized that I had the keys, you know, I could do that. It wasn't somebody else's purview. You know, somebody off in some exotic place. No, it was happening right there on our kitchen table. You know, it was really fun, and so that in the meantime, though, Dennis and I both went off and worked for newspapers, where we learned sort of the craft, the journalism, the photojournalism, the storytelling, caption writing, headline writing, doing research, all of those kinds of things. But eventually when we came together, and this would have been in the early 90s, Dennis, you'll know years better than me, there was a symbiosis of what we're interested in and where it might take us. And little by little, story by story, that started building. As we first did, well, the first story we did together was on the Colorado River, you know. And the interesting thing about that story was that we did not do it as a traditional National Geographic adventure story. You know, we're going to go down the wild Colorado and go through the rapids of the Grand Canyon and all that. No, this was a story about the resource, the water, and where it came from and where it went and who profited from it, and why it was such a desperately needed resource in such a dry land. All of those things, you know, set us on our path together that led to the many of the other stories that you saw in our presentation.
Right, and that started us on a path where then shortly after we did a piece on the Ogallala Aquifer that was addressing aquifer depletion, and that was more than a quarter century ago. And then we did a story that I had pitched on sustainable agriculture in the United States, that there was an emerging movement of farmers who were not wanting to take traditional pathways, but were trying to find a way to grow food ecologically soundly, yet economically profitably, and in a socially just way. And Verlin Klinkenborg wrote that piece, who wrote many years at the New York Times as an editorial writer. And that sort of, then we kept moving forward. I think the thing that has been interesting with Jim, while, you know, we each have done other things. Jim has done quite a bit of archaeology, and I did quite a lot of other sort of bigger global issue stories. But we continued to, for a quarter century almost, have a discussion about sort of, it was sort of an ongoing discussion about agriculture in America. And after the sustainable ag piece, then we did a piece on food safety. And this was after there was an infection that a kid got sick from eating a hamburger at the Jack in the Box, and E. coli got him. And then we did a story on genetically engineered crops. And then we did a piece on the Great Plains and what future for the Great Plains. And then as of, 2014, Jim and I and George Steinmetz collaborated with John Foley, who's now head of the Drawdown Project on the future of food. John wrote that story, was the first one. And so for a long time, I mean, really, Jim and I just have had this conversation about these issues of how does this work? What does it take to make it happen? All of these things are interconnected. Agriculture relies on water. Food relies on water, relies on energy, relies on climate. Population is dependent upon all those things. And that really is kind of the springboard that we have been using, I think, for everything that we have done over the years, including what we're doing now.
And you both, I mean, what was pretty interesting to me and definitely noteworthy is what I harp on all the time. This is one planet. It's an integrated system. Everything that happens at the bottom of the ocean impacts the air we breathe. And you've covered the gamut. I mean, food security, who was talking about it when you did it, and food safety? It's just, and it continues to plague and challenge us. And water, I mean, it's unbelievable to see when you wrote it and what's happening now. And I love the one that was said, cool it. Yeah, we better. That was my response. So anyway, so before we go any further, I do this. I get so caught up in the answers and how they grab me. We have to talk about what Eyes on the Earth is, because I know our listeners don't yet, but it's not just a website, it's an experience, and it does acknowledge that we're living in an unprecedented era of environmental change, and then you say the Anthropocene epoch, and I don't think that's on the tip of everyone's tongue. When you both explain it, it's not a complicated concept, but people get caught up in jargon, and I would love for you to explain for us what Eyes on Earth is all about. And I have many questions about its mission and on, but in the big picture, what is the Anthropocene epoch, and what was your vision for establishing this? I would call the website more of a movement than a website. It's not a static, it's a dynamic experience.
Dennis, why don't you go ahead?
So this Anthropocene idea, really, in 2011, we published a year-long series on the implication of world population at 7 billion. The world population passed 7 billion in about October of 2011, and we thought it would be a good occasion to try to have a discussion with our readers about what that meant. And as part of that series, we actually did a story on this Anthropocene, this proposed geologic epoch, which we became
epoch,
aware of.
Epoch, I'm sorry, I've been saying epoch. It wrong. Epoch, thank epoch. You.
Yeah, right.
I'm a rookie.
And it's not, you know, the thing is that scientists are, there are a group of scientists in what's called the Anthropocene Working Group who have proposed that this become a new geologic demarcation that appends to the end of the Holocene, which is the Holocene would be this sort of 10,000 or so year period where climate has become very amenable to the development of human civilization, where we've been living in a Goldilocks world not too hot, not too cold. It allowed agriculture to flourish, culture, human population. Well, so in about the year 2000, Eugene Sturmer from the University of Michigan and the Dutch chemist Paul Crutzen proposed that we had entered a new age, and that age was this human age that was marked by the presence, that the markings of our presence remain in the geologic record long after we are gone. And the scientists are now trying to figure out, well, when did it begin? Did it begin maybe 10,000 years ago when agriculture began? Did it begin, say, in the 1800s when we first discovered coal and started burning it and changing the chemistry of the atmosphere? Or did it begin in the middle of the last century when we started doing things like building and blowing up nuclear bombs? Well, so concurrent with that period of the nuclear age, though, there also was a rapid run-up in human population. It's been termed the Great Acceleration, where in my own lifetime, from the middle of the last century, we've seen a tripling of world population from 2.5 to 7.5 billion. The use of fossil fuel energy to power all this, to allow the dramatic uptick in the production of food, especially because of the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer that comes from natural gas. It all comes back to the fossil fuels that, you know, the coal, oil, and gas that we dig out of the ground. And then there's just been a tremendous transformation of the surface of the planet. When you look at the deforestation, the extinctions, and then you start looking at the impacts of this presence, and one of those has been the significant change in the chemistry of the atmosphere, which has caused the planet to start heating up. And now we're seeing a change in the ice cover and the weather and all this. And to us, I think both Jim and me, we felt like not only is this is a coherent narrative about where we are, it's also what we were also discovering was that most of the writing and the research and the discussion on this has been in words and in research and in academia, and we really there are very few other people who have been attempting to visualize this, and that's really been the core thing that we're asking: what does it look like? The Canadian photographer Edward Bertinsky, who has created an incredible epic photography of this, just has just mounted an exhibit in Canada, and a film that he was part of called Anthropocene was at the Toronto International Film Festival. So, you know, there are a few of us out there who are trying to say this is what it looks like.
So
Gina, you know, the thing is that what is interesting is whether or not the scientists decide on a particular date about when this new geological era started. Hard is one issue, but the bigger issue is that this change is all around us, and the fact of the matter is that it is so all around. It is so ubiquitous, you know, that sometimes we have a hard time recognizing it as something, you know, that we have a hard time seeing all those, you know, whether or not they are all the vast expansion of all the highways of the world, or the burning of all the coal, or the damming of all the rivers, or the lighting up of the night with the night lighting, or the draining of aquifers, or all those things. We tend to look at them each as their own story. And because news, by its definition, has a rather short threshold of time,
right,
you know, a short
right in an instant
level,
yes,
we perceived that we needed to do what we could to help others essentially see what's going on all around us. And as you mentioned, Dennis is retired, and, well, I'm going to be 71 in a couple of months.
And you both inspire me, and I'm getting close. It's like, yes, yes, look at them. Look what they're still doing. You go, girl. Yeah.
But I'm not going to go trekking across to up Mount Kilimanjaro. We need a new generation. We need a new generation who knows how to see this, and we need to be talking to those people, those young people, who are beginning their careers, for whom, 2050 is a date that comes up over and over again, Gina, because it's convenient. But also, you get to those population thresholds, the threshold of how much food we're going to have to grow, how much coal will have burned by then, what the temperature is going to be, all those things. All of this is going to happen in the next 30 to 50 years the working career of young people who are coming out of college now. And those are the people who are really the targets of Eyes on Earth. We essentially mean it as not only should we pay attention to what's going on Earth, but we need more. We need more eyes. We need more people watching, interpreting, communicating, understanding, showing us what it looks like. Without that cadre of people,
it's really a new narrative. We're just talking about beyond whether to further what Jim said, beyond what when it started. It's really a way to contemplate a new relationship with the Earth that supports us, and that it creates a narrative to help people understand where we fit in. And that's different than what you see in news, because everything is episodic, and then, the spotlight of disaster turns on to the next crisis, but we don't understand why it's happening. Well, what we're trying to do actually is to help raise awareness so people understand some of the causes and effects of what's going on.
If, in fact, it is even covered on the news as opposed to the latest tweet about Stormy Daniels. I'm like, who cares about this? The earth is burning. It's flooding. There's still nuclear waste in Fukushima. I don't care about Stormy Daniels. So there's my little rant. I'm not saying it's the last one of the show, because you guys really bring it out in me, but
we can rant pretty good too.
I'm going to give you time to rant. Okay? I'm going to give you, trust me, I have the last explosive question just pop waiting to pop. But so
we're very restrained.
Yeah, right. And that is an alt fact. So how does, I think we've established that environmental photography really helps to promote a different and perhaps, and no, not perhaps, for sure, a more engaging and impactful understanding of the Anthropocene or of what's going on Earth. In my common language, it is an effective tool and a distinct discipline for visual storytelling. So my next question is, does Eyes on Earth make the underlying causes of the incredible environmental changes we're experiencing, does it make it help make it more visible and accessible for public discussion and probably even impact policy decision making? And I don't want to be sarcastic ever, but it's like not policy decision making on the national level, but maybe in your local municipality or something, because I think that's what we'll have to do is focus on the things that we can change and we can impact decision making at the local level at this point. So do you think... Go ahead.
These kinds of things come up in many, many ways. For instance, many of us can. I'm looking right now at a picture of South American forest that has been denuded with and roads traced all over it. We all recognize that as an environmental impact. Anything that to do with rainforest has pretty much gotten on everybody's radar,
It's how I started my journey. I don't know if you both know. I'm sure you don't. But I was in Peru 10 years ago, and I had a big company and a massive social service organization in the country. And I came back and I said, I'm going to start a national radio show. And my husband, I wish I could show you the look on his face. He was like, you don't know anything about radio. And, you know, now I say, hey, baby, look at us now. So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt, but the Amazon is my soft spot, really and truly.
So we know that one. We all recognize that pretty much right now, and it always turns our stomach. But we don't necessarily think of it in the same way when you're looking at the vast fields of center pivot irrigation across the American Midwest, say, because, well, that change from a prairie with perennial grasses to a land of annual grasses happened 100 years ago, and it got a very nice name, thanks to people like Willa Cather, calling it a breadbasket. And yet, it is still a very large impact on the planet.
Totally,
you know, agriculture
yes.
is the single biggest impact on the planet in terms of the environment. And you go on and on and on of attuning your eye to be able to see these things that are all around you. The urban and suburban sprawl, the way the night sky is lit up, the way that Palmyra lost its soil 2,000 years ago and became a wasteland that we see today. All these things are part and parcel. The fracking of in West Texas, the expansion of agriculture across South America. Now the parallels would happen 100 to 150 years ago here in the Midwest, where I am. You know, all of those things are part and parcel of this bigger picture. You know, you mentioned a while ago archaeology, and Dennis mentioned the coming of the Holocene, and those things are all connected because, well, the Neolithic, the thing that happened way back then, is really means the beginning of agriculture, and that was the big trigger, you know, that made all of our cities and all of our civilizations possible today. But we always have to remember that each one of those things came with a cost. And we live, you know, our daily lives. All those cheeseburgers come at the cost of something, you know, in our world. And we simply want to help people see it. Now, you said at what level, you know, at the national level, yeah, or international level, yeah, the rainforest, denuding of the rainforest is an easy one. But wind farms are many in our backyards, you know. Many of these things are really in our backyards, but we become overly familiar with them. And so that we react strongly to the foreign threat, but we don't react very strongly to what's right in our backyard very much.
Gina, you asked about impact and change and policy. And, you know, we think about that a lot, and I had the good fortune last week to participate in the Wisconsin Science Festival in Madison, where I had been in grad school, I dare say, 45 years ago.
But doesn't that blow you away when you're saying those things? It's like, what?
They still invited me back, and I gave essentially a version of the talk that Jim and I gave in April, and you know, the question about what are you trying to achieve? And there's this sort of contemporary framework about if you're a foundation, you know, you invest your money in some project, and then there need to be some measurable metrics of success. And what are the outcomes you're. I don't know how to measure changing the mindset of somebody who's in college, because I think that is really our target. What we're trying to do is raise this issue and this idea as a discipline of awareness with young people who are trying to figure out where they're going in this world. And they haven't made their deal with society yet, and that maybe what we can do is to help them think about the world in a way that maybe they might not have otherwise, and that by that awareness, it may change the direction of their lives. And you know, this whole thing about how do we measure that, I don't know. I mean, I think about there's a poem by Wendell Berry that I've loved for many, many years. It's called the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. And within it, there's a, you know, there's a one paragraph that says, ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. I think that's really where we're, at least where I am. It's like all we can do is kind of plant seeds, and maybe down the line, by the choices that young people have made, that will be the, you know, that will be the crop that we weren't around to see the harvest.
And to your point, when you go to something like Planet Forward, I always describe it as being in the bubble of possibility and hope and solutions, because there are young minds. But what Frank and Dan and those people do is they do what I think is the best possible. They combine the worlds of wisdom and experience and knowledge, translation, older people like us, with those young minds, those bright minds that are asking the questions about what if and what can happen. One of you said about the, you know, kind of the connectivity of all of this and the Great Plains. I did a show a while back, and of course I don't remember. It all becomes mush after about a week. But it was with a woman from the World Wildlife Federation. And I think her name was like, I don't know, she was a representative, Shammy. She had a name like Shammy Anderson. And the show blew me away because it was about the connection. She talked a lot about the connection between, they're trying to, you know, reintroduce the bison in some meaningful way, but their connection between that and the black-footed ferret, about the symbiotic relationship they have on the success of the bison on the Great Plains. And it is what both of you do so well, is say it's all connected. And it's not just, you know, you can do this over here and it doesn't have an impact on this over there. So, okay, what about, do you think, how does a body of work like Eyes on the Earth help to establish effective ways that young people or people reinventing themselves, that environmental photography can make a difference in our world and its future? I would think that's hugely why you did it, because you're giving people resources to help us and make a difference and help with our future. How does it do that?
In the simplest terms, I hark back to something that I, if anybody quotes me, they often quote this, because I told photographers one time that if you want to be a better photographer, stand in front of more interesting stuff. And
I believe that you
said
that.
I was just looking for a really simple, dirt simple way of telling somebody, you know, well, what do you do? I mean, you know, it's all well and good to say be inspired, but, you know, on day-to-day going to work kind of job like we do, you know, what are you going to do? I think for apropos to your question about the young people, the question of a person with a camera always comes down to, what do you choose to stand in front of? You know, we like to talk a lot about knob turning, you know, in photography. But the fundamental question of what does that photographer as a person, a citizen of the world, choose to stand in front of and show to us is the paramount nexus of all this. And so if we can say to those young photographers, you know, think at least a part of your life and your career about, you know, what are you going to stand in front of in the next 20 to 30 years? You know, what kind of things are you going to photograph, and what kind of things are you going to show us? And we fundamentally need that. It's all well and good for somebody to talk, as we said, about the cutting down of the rainforest, but I want to see what the heck it looks like. You know, what are you talking about? You know, show me that thing. And we particularly talk about environmental photography because while we both came out of photojournalism is increasingly caught up in the moment and particularly violent moments and the disasters of the world, you know, but the short-term disasters of the world, not the disasters that take a year or a decade or a century to happen, you know. Conservation photography does wonderful things. I think, you know, about the woman you were talking about with the bison and the black-footed ferrets and the need to preserve that land for future generations of wildness, which is essentially what conservation photography does. But we're thinking about something different than both of those. And when we talk about environmental photography, we're talking about the huge impacts that Dennis started out talking about with the Anthropocene, the kind of impacts that geologists can see in the layers of the sediments, you know, but really are playing out all over the world, you know. So if we had a, you know, Dennis was talking about the foundations and deliverables, you know, I guess if we had a deliverable, you know, I would say if in the next 15 years we could find 5, 10, 100, 1,000, you know, young people to inspire to go out and do the work of seeing this vast change.
So we were talking about sort of where this comes from partly, and that does come back to awareness of the role of science in society, and that's really when Jim and I started working together, these story ideas, where do they come from? Well, number one, they didn't come from the news media. They by and large came from science journals. That's where we started finding ideas, and often what I would do would then take a whole bunch of studies and look at them and look to see how they were connected on any number of things. Like we published a project in 2004 on climate change that had 70 odd pages, and every picture in that project was backed by some sort of published peer-reviewed study. And so I think part of the idea is for to become comfortable and aware of the role of scientific research and making that visual. And I think the other thing too is, you know, we're not talking just about problems. We're talking about possibilities. And when we sort of try to inculcate a new generation of seers, people with cameras, people who are observing the world and trying to record it and tell stories about it visually, you know, there's also the idea that it's also good to try to point out what good is happening. And that's one thing that we have tried to do across the table, and I think that's something that in my own talks, I will close with an extended soliloquy on well, what are the best ways to cut climate change, and take that and make that visual, because what you really are trying to do is to try to expand the sort of the landscape of the imagination. You're trying to help people realize, number one, that there are issues that we have to confront, but there are also possibilities for us to create a better future if we all work together.
And I want to just interject here that when you spend time at the site, like, why am I so enthusiastic? Why do I sound so exuberant and passionate about inviting people to look? And I want to point out...
Sure, Gina?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you're pretty much that way every day, aren't you?
Well, you know, right. You don't want to get me started on some of the things of late. I'm not so nice, and I'm trying to curate my language. But... this is what I would like to, I hope it's thought-provoking to our thousands of listeners, because on the site, there are some what I would call beautiful and expected pictures. Beautiful. All the photographs are gorgeous. So the picture of the harvesting in Ethiopia, for example, it's a beautiful picture. But the provocative or evocative or other kinds of, you've been able to successfully put a different I can't quite get it, like a spin or a perspective to things. For example, and I really want you to answer, to talk about this for a minute, not this one in particular, but when you're showing, agricultural dominance in the state of Washington, that's, okay, I understand that. But then you show strip cropping in Wisconsin, right? Mm-hmm. The Ethiopian picture I love. But then you stop because it says stop cultivating to stop wind erosion in Colorado. Well, you can't really describe that. You have to see that. So it's like, people, you have to see that. But the one I really want you to talk to me about, because I don't even get it, what's up with the tree planting in China? That picture is scary as heck. But what's going on there? I mean, I know they're trying to plant trees and they're going to deploy 60,000 soldiers to plant trees, but what's up with that picture? That is really, like, first of all, I thought it was a beehive when it was small. Then I looked and I said, oh, that's not a beehive. That's awful. Or is
well,
it?
Well, what for the sake of the listeners here, we'll talk about a picture. So what you're looking at there is a picture of denuded raw soil, denuded hills, quite steep hills. And there are all these little pockets in it. And what's going on there is that this is in the region of the Yellow River. And the reason that the Yellow River is yellow is in China is because of this incredible soil runoff from the Lush Plateau. This is a region of the Lush Plateau. And over the last several thousand years, they cut down all the trees. I mean, that's a common theme. I mean, wherever you go in the world and you see some problem and everybody says, one of the first things they say is, well, they cut down all the trees.
Exactly. Houston, we've got a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So what they are trying to do in China, and China is undertaking this huge venture, is that in order to plant a tree on those steep hillsides there, what you have to do is you go out and you make a kind of a pocket. This is about 2 feet across, a pocket kind of dammed up on the lower side of the hill, 8 or 10 inches deep. And what you hope is that it'll collect some water, it'll collect some leaves, they might compost in there enough to make you some better soil, and that you could plant a tree in that little pocket, and it would have a chance to grow. That's what you hope. And if you do this enough, you might start to bring back the trees that haven't been gone for 2,000 years across much of China. That's what's going on. It is such a big deal for the Chinese that March 12th is their Arbor Day, and everybody in China, virtually every peasant, every farmer, everybody in town on March 12th goes out and they plant trees.
It's huge
numbers of trees.
It's
yes.
good for all of us. I mean, it really is. And
it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I get it. And it's watershed management also with those little pockets. And then another one I want to point out for the listeners who can't see it, unless they're listening on their computer and they can switch over to this website, Eyes on Earth. So then there's the one with the dead birds. So what did that bring up in me? It was not like horror. It was what I think consciously human beings, which is always what gets me in trouble. It's like that phrase, because not everybody's living consciously, is if you think that man and our encroachment on their territory hasn't had an impact. Mm-hmm. And for everybody, it is a very graphic picture of many, many birds that are lined up that died as a result of running into skyscrapers. Well, folks, here's my big news flash. We didn't have skyscrapers 100 years ago, I don't even think. At least not in the United States, maybe, but not. I don't think so. We were still pretty much agrarian 100 years ago. So that was one that I thought, my mini-me, nasty-me said, any idiot can look at this and see that there's man's impact on the birds. And then the other one that got to me, because I love I am in love with all sea turtles, is the impact of of light on on their migratory patterns, and they get, you know, so it's like, yes, men, women, and children, we are the ones that have encroached on their territory, and we are paying for it, as are they. So it's like, a picture is worth a thousand words. I don't know how many times I said that when I was looking at the website, and it sounds so pithy, but it's so true. You can't, you cannot really experience the global drama of what's happening unless you look at this and see what's happening all around us. So I think that was another direct rant, so I digress. But anyway,
well, but you were getting at, Gina, the complexity of it, and Dennis and I have dealt with this a lot on a lot of stories of if you are going to do if you're going to try and talk about something like light pollution, and that's kind of essentially the bird picture and the turtle picture that you're talking about. We're both from our story about light pollution. You have to be able to show impacts, and you have to be able to show them in an interesting way. The birds was up in Toronto, and there is a man I discovered. There is a man who goes around and makes it his mission in life to go around in the mornings and collect the birds that ran into the skyscrapers overnight because of the light, bright lights, you know. And he hopes to save the ones who are just kind of knocked silly for the moment. But he also collects the ones that unfortunately died. And they keep them, and then every year they get them out and they do a count. So that they can start to get some idea of, you know, how many birds are dying this way. And, you know, maybe, what can you do about it? You know, that would be nice if there's something that you can ameliorate all of this. But for our purposes, it comes down to those kind of things. Well, you know, where do you go to show this? You know, where do you go to that it can have the kind of impact that can fire up the curiosity that inspires people to understand? Because I think that's the critical factor, is if people come to understand what's going on, then they have some power to do something. You know, for instance, down there on the beaches in Florida where you saw the turtle, you know, turn the lights down at night.
Yes. I mean, we're doing so much work in our city. We are doing a lot of work, and a lot of us helped get some laws passed about new buildings and what you have to do and what, you know, having the lights all face downward, not the big spotlights that are lighting the sky, because we have a lot of incredible telescopes here, both on Mount Lemmon and in another site where we're doing, you know, lots of observation with the sky at night, and you can't do it if it's too bright. So it's a really big, it's like even an economic impact for us if that goes away. Mm-hmm. So there's a great quote on the website, and even if you don't want to respond to it, I just said, I have to say this on the website, on the show, because it is reflective of your work, in my opinion. And I don't know whose quote it is, but it's beautiful. It says, "We cannot save what we cannot see, thus eyes on earth. We will not save what we do not value." And I guess what I wanted to ask with this one is, it's such an incredible body of work, and I'm going to ask more in the next question, is what else are you doing? You're not just saying, oh yeah, go visit my website and hope it changes your life. You're actively doing things. It obviously had an impact on me, though. And do you have stories that, one or two inspirational stories of a life you've touched or of something that came out as a result of all this work?
Oh, Dennis, you've had a broad spectrum of those kind of things.
Well, I mean, for example, I'm now involved in helping, I don't know what you would call it, distant educating, but I'm helping frame and originate a year-long class in environmental storytelling on the Willamette River Valley that is being that was started this fall at the University of Oregon School of Journalism in Eugene. And I'll be going out there next month to spend a week with the students in the class to help them identify the projects that they're going to be working on. So, you know, this question about, you know, change or impact, I think it's like, these are all long-term changes, and
right.
it takes this whole question about, like, for example, oh, my goodness, we've realized that climate change is a problem. We better do something or the world's going to end. But excuse me, we've been living on coal, oil, and gas for hundreds of years, and it took a long time to get to where we are. It's going to take a while to get out of it, and these are generational challenges. And so I'm just really trying, as Jim is, we're at a point where we're trying to now, we've become aware of something, we're trying to make sense of it, we're trying to help young people understand that the role of photography in society or in awareness is not just what pictures look like, but what they mean.
Yes.
And what,
yes.
What stories they tell. And if we can get that sort of a raised awareness and imagination, well, then, you know, maybe we'll see, as Jim said earlier, maybe we'll see 10 or 15 people in a decade or so, or even beyond our own lifetime, where they went, oh, I understand, it's all connected. I realize that there are all these challenges, but I'm going to focus on, who knows, maybe somebody wants to say they're going to devote their life to documenting how we have created regenerative agriculture,
right,
or rooftop,
right,
solar, you see.
Right.
And so you're painting a picture. They're painting a picture of the art of the possible, and that's part of this.
So we have, like, not a lot of time unless we want to make this, like, a two-hour podcast, which I'm saying, like, I'm up for it. I'm up for it, but I want to hear the soliloquy, and then I have a last question and a last comment. So let's hear the soliloquy. Who offered that? Was it you, Jim, or you, Dennis? I have a soliloquy.
I don't have any idea.
Okay.
It may have been both of us. It may have been both of us, and we edited each other, or vice versa. It sounds great.
It may have already happened.
Like a great quote.
Yeah, I'm so wrapped up in the show. I mean, sometimes I'm so, this is absolutely the truth spoken into word. If his show is really good, which this one is, I'm so wrapped up in the answer that I forget you stopped. And it's like, oh, Gina, you have to come back to the, because I want the story to go on. So I'm trying to stay sharp here. So my last question, and I just had to ask it because it is so obviously political that I had to think about it. So I hope you're both good with it. I know you're both good with it. And I'm just going to read it as I wrote it. How can any intelligent, consciously living, or not even consciously living human being see what you have seen, see what you have documented through the lens of your camera, through the prism of reality? You shared it with us, and how could anyone not believe in human-caused global warming? How can anyone not feel what I did when I looked at this and understand the impact? You didn't have to explain to me about the birds. It's like, yeah, man's impact on the earth. I just looked at it and went, oh my gosh, yeah, we didn't have skyscrapers when they first inhabited the earth. Do you have any good answer to that? What is the blockage here of proof and evidence and 99% of scientists? I think you'll both be delighted in answering that.
Jim?
Dennis, go ahead.
Okay, so look, I think that the issue that we have to understand is that more evidence isn't necessarily going to change hearts or minds, and that we're in a world where people they see the world through their own view, and it may be that it's not possible for them to accept these ideas because maybe they're culturally ingrained not to. Maybe they are somebody who earns their livelihood from mining coal or owning coal mines, or gets money from people who gets money from people who have interests in seeing that oil continue to be a big part of our energy future. Everybody comes at this from different points of view, and there are some people in society who are very, just as there are people in society who are very adamant that we must do something now, there are also groups in society who say, hey, what's the problem? So in one sense, I think those really aren't the people who we are trying to connect to. That's in the sort of the bell curve of population, you know, there's a vast middle out there who are trying to make sense of all this, and that's why we exist. But I think even more pointedly, that's why we also exist. We see ourselves as targeting young people who are coming of age and who are trying to make their way in the world. And I think that is, in terms of when one is trying to figure out where can we make the biggest impact, where can we open eyes and minds, where possibilities exist for awareness and change, it's in the young people. It's not necessarily in the people who are set in their ways.
And that's a wonderful answer. And it calmed me down a little bit. My Irish temper calmed down just a little bit, because where I go with that answer is it was beautiful and it was kind and it was truthful. And what I say to myself is, I'm a mother and I'm a grandmother, and I'm going to be a grandmother again. What is going on here, folks? Because with all of those things that you said that are legitimate, if I was the head of household for a family and I was bringing the money in because of my work at the coal power plant, I would do it. But hopefully I would think that there's got to be a better way, and I wouldn't want my son or daughter to work there. I'd want them to find a better way, a cleaner way, a healthier way. So that's what happens for me. Anything else that you want to add? Because we really
Gina?
Do. Yes.
Yeah. You know, I think relative to what you're talking about, that yes, we are in a state today, particularly in America, in which at each extreme we have a relatively small, ideologically ossified groups of people on both extremes of the political set.
You're right.
And that those, for those people, unfortunately, if they accept any piece of the ideology of the other group, that they are corrupted and alienated from their tribe, you know, that's the extreme place. But in between. There's a lot of people who are just tired of that kind of polarization.
Thank you.
And that's who we want to talk to. That's who we want to show these things to, because we're convinced that when reasonable people see things, you know, that they are intelligent and that they can make reasonable decisions. And so if we can do anything, you know, if there was a wish, it would be that simple observation and intelligent interpretation of those observations, you know, would again come to the forefront of how we make policy decisions in this country and in the world, you know. And I'm not at all convinced that can't happen, because I think there is such a fatigue of the kinds of things that you were just expressing in your own voice, I think.
Yes, you know? and mine was showing, and thank you so much sincerely for bringing me back to the world that I wish to see, which is more common ground. And I do cover things about that when you talk to hunters that you think might be adversarial. So many hunters really are actively engaged in preservation of species. There's so many other examples of that. So thank you for reminding me. I do get, there is that fatigue and frustration, and of late some of the coverage that's been on the national news, which I also try to avoid. That's what I say to people. So the answer was very, very, thank you. Yes.
You got to be in it for the long haul.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes, we do. So everybody, let's hope that everyone who listens to this podcast, who takes the time to visit and explore Eyes on Earth, will be inspired to talk about it and share and engage people in meaningful conversations. I have to listen to my own words about the clear, present, and everyday evidence of human-caused climate change. From where I sit, all of our lives depend on us pulling together in the right direction. And the operative word here is all of us, and our lives really do depend on it. So to both of you, thank you for your contribution to helping us work to a world that is sustainable and socially just, because that's the kind of planet that I want to live on. So thank you for taking the time, and I'm certainly glad that you crossed my path so that I could share your story with the people that are wanting to know what stories I have to share. So thank you both.
Jeannie, you've been very kind. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for having us. It's been a great pleasure.
It was great. Thank you both.